I told the court that I'm wrong to imprison
you. Mr. Assume, you are not to address the jury.
There's too much being hid from you.
You need to be taken out of the court.
There's too much.
He was one small man in a giant wheel caught.
Well, I do wish to say that it's official that I'm wrongfully imprisoned right now.
Uncover, Season 7, Dead Wrong.
I asked him if he killed Pipple. He said yes, and I'd be next.
Available on CBC Listen and wherever you get your podcasts. This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Brent Bambury. This is Day 6.
The Toronto Public Library system was hacked.
Cybersecurity incident has knocked out several city-run services.
Infiltrated this Toronto hospital's computer system.
Toronto Zoo hit by a cyber attack.
Cities under cyber attack as hackers have the upper hand. That's coming up on Day 6. Today, anti-vaxxers cash in.
That kind of cash has enabled them to grow their influence.
Vaccine rates fall, but anti-vax nonprofits are making big bucks. Math in drag.
Anybody can love math, and it doesn't matter what you look like.
Drag queen Kine Santos makes math fabulous and fun. And burn this book.
It's a deprived future for these children.
The books right-wing activists want banned and the kids who defend them. All today on Day 6, the Read Me My Rights edition.
We, the general public, don't grasp that this is really escalating, and it's been escalating for a while. So we sort of don't take the threat as seriously as we should. We look at the news, we sort of wave our hands, not again, and here we go. We continue and wait for the next breach to occur.
Natalia Stahanova is the Canada Research Chair in Security and Privacy and a professor at the University of Saskatchewan. She's reacting to the news that Hamilton, Ontario, is the latest city to be hit by a ransomware attack. After more than a week, many of the city's services still aren't available. City Council has delayed meetings because councillors don't have the things they need to do their work. And some long-term homes are operating without phone lines. In January, the Toronto Zoo was hit by a cyber attack. Last fall, it was the Toronto Public Library system. It's taken more than 4 months to get the libraries fully functioning again. And in 2022, the small town of St. Mary's, Ontario, spent more than $1 million investigating a ransomware attack on its local government.
I think it's very scary to think about this, right? It's no longer a lonely hacker sitting in the basement, as we kept thinking, you know, even, 5, 10 years ago, you would see an article and they're talking about these people in the basement. And, no, it's this organization. This is industry.
Jason Eastreet spends his life trying to fight that industry. His job is to try to hack into the systems of large corporations and institutions in order to test their security systems to see where they're weak. So he's a hacker with legal permission. Jason, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brent, for having me. I really appreciate it.
When you hear that a city's been the victim of a ransomware attack, what's the first thing that comes to mind for you?
My first thing that comes to me is, again, because it is the times that this is a one-off incident is past. It is going to be a common occurrence for the next couple of years until better implementations are put in to prevent it.
Given the implementation that exists now for a mid-sized Canadian city like Hamilton, how many access points can you think of that might get you into a city's network?
Way too many to count. Ransomware is so prevalent right now because it is so easy to orchestrate and use, and there's so many different ways to get in. Usually it's going to be either someone, you know, bringing something in, a device in, and then plugging it into the network, or, you know, most likely it is someone sending a link or sending an email or calling someone on the phone and directing them to a website. I personally own a website. It looks 100% legitimate. And when I direct someone to this website, it instantly executes a code in the back end that they don't even see.
Right. But it's very complicated because you just told us that you set up an entire website that looks credible.
Yes.
And that many people who are trained security experts will make a mistake and click on something in that will create a vulnerability.
Yes. 100%. And one of the things that stops that is when we train our delivery drivers, we train them properly on how to operate the equipment they're given. But when we give our employees a computer, we don't give them the proper training on how to operate and safely use that equipment. We're just telling them, do this, don't click on links, and thinking that's enough. And the problem is we're relying on technology to protect the user instead of getting our employees as the first line of defense and then using the technology as a safety net.
Okay, well, let's look at a vulnerable system through your eyes. What's the low-hanging fruit for you? What are the ways you can easily hack into a system or network?
The easiest way that I specialize in is I literally walk in the door. I've walked into a bank in another country, and within 15 seconds, I'd compromised the first machine by plugging in a USB drive directly into one of their terminals. I then talked to the manager and had the manager escort me to every other machine in the entire bank, including their network server room, and compromised every machine in that bank 100%, including the one that was doing the wire transfers. And basically, it's because we don't assume risk sometimes. It's like when we feel like we're in a safe area or we feel like we're in our work, we forget that there's going to be danger.
You've also talked about sending an envelope to office workers and it has a USB key inside.
Oh, yes.
If someone receives a USB key in an envelope addressed to them, how often does that get plugged in?
Almost 100%, because I don't really even mail it. It's like I'm leaving it on their desk where they think they're secure. One of the things that I will mail to someone, especially to IT, I will send them keyboards, like really cool light-up gamer keyboards, because I have opened that box before and I've replaced the USB-C cable that came with it. So as soon as that cable is plugged in, it gets control of the whole machine.
Well, that sounds pretty high-tech, but you know, I get phished all the time. If I just open an email without clicking on any links, does that expose me to hacking?
Yes. It depends on what operating system or what device, but phishing is a huge problem, and it still is, because it's using a lot of human emotions of like, oh, you have to open up this, or this is something that you're about to miss out on.
Right.
That's the reason why a lot of the UPS scams and a lot of the CEOs, I'm in a meeting and I need this sent directly to me, those work because it shows a sense of urgency.
Mm-hmm.
The key thing that I always tell people is look at a computer as a car. If you received a cardboard box on top of the hood of your car and it had the CEO's name on it, would you automatically just pick that up and put it in your car and think that was, or open it?
Right.
You'd be suspicious because you know in the real world, that's not normal. You have to just take a moment to step back and say, how often do I get a request like this? And it just takes that second moment of being like, this may be suspicious. And also understanding that mistakes are made, and what fixes it is reporting it immediately, because a 5-minute breach can be a big pain in the rump for the next week or so. A 5-month breach that no one knew about because no one reported it can destroy a company.
Hmm. Back to the city of Hamilton. They say, yes, in this ransomware attack, they say that they don't think anyone's data was accessed. What do you think?
Yeah, that's nice to believe. And I like to think that, you know, unicorns still exist somewhere in the world, but I don't think it's, you know, very likely. The problem is that they're also getting into extortion now, where they not only just ransom the data, but they actually copy it and threaten to release it to the public if the ransom is not paid.
If you were running a big system like this and it got breached, would you pay the ransom or would you rebuild the entire system, which is what the Toronto Library had to do? And that took months, not to mention probably a lot of money.
I would spend that money to build the systems better. We do not pay criminals for criminal activity. They don't deserve to be rewarded for what they're acting, because then they're going to do it even worse to someone else.
But can you foolproof a system? And I know that's your job, but if someone is determined to hack into a system, is that hack inevitable or can it be prevented?
I hate to tell you this, but in certain areas, it can be. It's about degrees. If you have sensitive data, like your customer records and your data that is like way more protected than anything else, then why is it on the same network that your accounting department can access?
Mm-hmm.
you should have a even more secured area networked that is segmented off from everyone else, and it's only in that area resides that data. So in other words, you've got a moat to keep everybody out from the main part of the castle. Well, I'm saying that you should have another section where the dungeon is, where all mm-hmm. your personal private data should be. And so even if they break into the rest of the castle, they still didn't have the access to the crown jewels.
Based on what you're seeing and experiencing, how hopeful are you about cybersecurity moving forward?
I honestly am very hopeful, because one of the things these criminals don't realize is the more they make this more public, the more people are going to be aware of it and the least effective they're going to be. But it's just educating people to be more cautious and more aware, and then hopefully they'll fail more.
Jason E. Street, really nice to meet you. Thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you, Brent.
Jason E. Street is a hacker, author, and expert on cybersecurity. Here are some other stories we're keeping an eye on this weekend.
This situation is beyond untenable for the people of Haiti.
Haiti is in a state of emergency. Armed gangs are expanding control over the nation's capital, forcing thousands to flee. The UN says the country's health system is on the brink of collapse. Fighting escalated last week when Prime Minister Ariel Henry left the country to attend a regional summit. Henry took over when the former president was assassinated. He was never democratically elected. One powerful gang leader is calling for him to step down. Henry has been unable to return to Haiti since he left last week. And
we support the genocide of innocent babies, of innocent women, and innocent men.
Tensions are escalating over pro-Palestinian protests in Canadian cities. Earlier this week, demonstrators targeted two high-profile political events in Toronto. In one case, a reception with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni was cancelled. On Thursday, police arrested three people who allegedly attacked protesters outside a Toronto area synagogue. The synagogue was hosting an event marketing property in Israel and the occupied West Bank. There were protests earlier this week outside a similar event at a synagogue in Montreal. A Quebec court has since temporarily prohibited protests near several Jewish institutions in Montreal. Supporters of the ruling say protesters have no business targeting Jewish faith institutions. Protest organizers say they were targeting the real estate event.
This is actually the first women's game I'm going to this season, but I just thought, like, for such a big milestone, might as well just go all out, be right there. Just something I'll remember forever.
And that guy was not alone. He was one of thousands lining up to see University of Iowa basketball star Caitlin Clark, because this is her season for breaking records. In February, she broke the NCAA's women's career scoring record. And on Sunday, she broke the all-time scoring record for both men and women.
I'm going to record and say she's the best female collegiate player ever.
And Shaquille O'Neal knows a thing or two about basketball.
Caitlin Clark is arguably the most popular women's basketball player ever because she arrived in a time that was primed and ready. These great athletes that came before her sort of set the stage. And then when you account for both streaming and the ability to find games online, along with national networks being willing and actually hungering to have these games on national television because of the kind of ratings they're getting, it's allowing for a nation of people to come along to her greatness.
Sarah Spain is an award-winning journalist and correspondent for ESPNW. And Caitlin Clark isn't just breaking scoring records. Ticket sales for University of Iowa games are booming, no matter where they're playing.
So Iowa has sold out every single game except for two neutral site games in Florida. Many of the opponents they've played have never sold out a women's basketball game before until Caitlin Clark arrived. The newest story that is just absolutely wild is Fox admitting that they considered an NIL deal paying Caitlin Clark to stay at Iowa for another season because she has another season of eligibility because the ratings that Fox is getting on Iowa games are so high. It was almost 4 million people the other day. That's more than the NBA openers on TNT. That's more than Victor Wembanyama's debut game in the NBA on ESPN. It's more than every single men's college basketball game except for one this season. It's a force that even the networks are thinking of outside-the-box opportunities to keep her in this space and in the collegiate game because they know the eyeballs that she's getting.
And taken together, this is what people are calling the Caitlin Clark effect.
I would say the Caitlin Clark effect for me, because of how fun she is to watch, because of the way she's got everyone talking, is change the mindset of not just the fans who are now demanding more of the stuff they want to see that isn't just the big four men's sports, but also the program directors, the editors, people in newsrooms that have maybe historically been a little bit lazy about putting together the rundowns for their radio and TV shows, their newspapers and their websites. For such a long time, it had to be such a standout story or a very specific name like Serena Williams, say, for them to think outside the box instead of saying, okay, what's the big news in the NBA, MLB, NHL? And now, because of Caitlin, it won't just be what's Caitlin up to or what's Iowa basketball's schedule. But we feel like we have to be more intentional about looking at women's sports, female athletes, leagues like the NWSL, the PWHL, places where stars can shine if you give them the spotlight. But she has become such a big thing that it's going to be very hard for these places to retreat even after she's out of college and not consider looking around and saying, oh, what about Juju Watkins? What about Hannah Hidalgo? What about these other superstars coming up that we could try to take advantage of by letting people see them and love them too?
And the Caitlin Clark effect also applies to future athletes who have a new hero to look up to.
I'm on the women's board for Gatorade, and one of the big things we're tackling is why girls drop out of sports at double the rate of boys, right around between 6th and 8th grade. And one of the biggest factors is a lack of role models, a lack of financial incentive, and a lack of investment from schools or parents because they don't believe there's this long runway for athletes, female athletes, to continue competing. Growing up and seeing not only are there professional leagues for softball, basketball, volleyball, soccer, all these different sports, but there's an ability to make money off my name, image, and likeness at the collegiate level in addition to scholarships. There's an ability to make money off of endorsements and via social media interest. But all of that combines so that if you're a little girl right now growing up and you see the absolute craziness around Caitlin Clark, you have no other choice but to think, I could do that, and look where that's taking her. And there were just so few examples of that growing up. It never really felt like much of an option for those of us decades ago.
Sarah Spain is a correspondent for ESPNW. March Madness games for NCAA women, where Caitlin Clark will inevitably be a huge factor, begin on March 20th. Still to come on day six, Kyne Santos brings glamour to math. We meet the author of Math in Drag.
It's just to show people that math can be fun.
And we're seeing a significant rise in global measles cases. We know there's lots of travel, international travel, and people landing in Canada. And of course, we have measles cases here in Canada. So we have to really make sure our vaccine rates are well above 90%. To prevent onward transmission and subsequent cases in Canada.
Cases of measles have been popping up across Canada in the last few weeks. There aren't a lot of them, not quite a dozen, according to a CBC News count. But that's almost as many as were reported in all of 2023. The good news is we have a very efficient vaccine for measles. All we have to do is make sure enough people get it. The bad news is that the latest federal data shows that only about 80% of kids are up to date on their shots by their 7th birthday. And new polling shows parents have become more skeptical of vaccinations since COVID. The pandemic was marked by a growing lack of trust in medicine and science. And now new reporting from the Washington Post shows that four nonprofit groups that were already known for their anti-vax advocacy got richer and more powerful through the pandemic. Lauren Weber is health and science accountability reporter with the Washington Post. Lauren, welcome to Day 6.
Thanks so much for having me.
You tracked four groups who've been raising a lot of money by trading in misinformation around science. How lucrative have the last few years been for these groups?
So what I found by analyzing all the tax records that are available from 2020 to 2022 is that the four nonprofits that you mentioned managed to collectively gain more than $118 million during the height of the pandemic, which enabled them to do a lot of things. They were able to deepen their influence in state houses, courtrooms, and communities really across the U.S.
And I'd like to zero in on these four U.S.-based nonprofit organizations. Two of them are straight-up anti-vax groups. Who are they?
So the two you are referencing are Children's Health Defense, which is an anti-vaccine group that was actually founded by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. They raised $23.5 million in contributions during 2022 alone, which was eight times what they got in 2019 before the pandemic began. The other influential anti-vaccine group is Informed Consent Action Network, which also was able to raise a substantial amount more of money.
Let's look at Children's Health Events, because RFK Jr. has had his profile amplified by his candidacy in the presidential election. And I'm curious, what do you think is going to happen to this nonprofit as the election campaign continues? And Robert F. Kennedy's candidacy is going to be part of that.
Look, you know, the medical director of that nonprofit was recently invited to speak on the Hill by Senator Ron Johnson. You know, Children's Health Defense, we only have the tax cuts through 2022, but I expect that with the more media attention they've been able to raise from this and with RFK Jr.'s more media attention, they're going to continue to have influence not only in the U.S., but in other countries with their messaging.
The other two nonprofit organizations you looked at are Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance and America's Frontline Doctors. How would you describe the work they do?
So they would both describe themselves slightly differently than the first two. You know, they both promoted antiparasitic or antimalarial drugs of ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine as treatments for COVID long after regulators and clinical trials found those medications to be ineffective or potentially harmful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the FLCCC, as they're known by, you know, still continues to kind of promote other treatments, alternative treatments for different conditions. And America's Frontline Doctors has really taken up the anti-mandate fight when it comes to vaccines or other medical-related mandates across the country.
Critical Care Alliance talks about providing medical information that's not beholden to special interests. What does that language suggest to you?
So that's rhetoric we're seeing more and more from groups like the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance. And really, oftentimes you'll hear Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Children's Health Defense folks use that kind of rhetoric, and they use it because it's powerful. I mean, you know, here in the U.S., a lot of people face astronomical medical bills that seem arbitrary mm-hmm. and unrelated to care. You know, the medical system is fractured and difficult to navigate and can leave people failing to seek care until it's too late. So this kind of rhetoric that, you know, big pharma, big hospitals, big private equity, you know, you'll avoid that by coming to us is really powerful for some people.
You reported in all four of these cases, the group's leaders, the nonprofit's leaders, are now being paid a lot more than they were a few years ago. Why is it important for you to reveal that?
I think it's important to reveal what they spent the money on. You know, they raised so much more money. So where did it go? And I mean, the salaries really went up in that time frame. You know, RFK Jr.'s salary doubled from 2019 to 2022, more than doubled. You know, Simone Gold, who founded America's Frontline Doctors, was paid over $500,000 in 2022. You know, these are serious cash sums that, you know, when you look at their tax forms, are important to account for.
Executive compensation is not the only thing they're doing with all that money. Now that they're significantly better financed than they used to be, what else is going on? How are they spending it?
That kind of cash has enabled them to grow their influence, whether that be building out their social media empires, you know, funding some of their podcasts, enabling them to travel to testify in state houses across the country, or enabling state chapters where they can kind of have influence at a state legislative level, or funding lawsuits. You know, lawsuits, various groups have funded different lawsuits that fight different things that their group believes in. You know, all of this money has gone to a variety of different actions for each of these groups.
What do you make of the lawsuits and the litigiousness?
I think that litigation is an important tool for them to achieve their objective goals. And for, as we discussed, two of the groups, those are goals that are against vaccines. So whether that's rolling back vaccine mandates, like Informed Consent Action Network has successfully sued to or funded a suit in Mississippi that enabled a religious exception. And they're trying to get more of those religious exemptions in the last five states that banned them. You know, these are this money goes to lawsuits in order to enable them to reach their ultimate goals.
We're seeing right now a spread of measles in Europe, in the U.S., here in Canada as well. In some places, the spike in cases is alarming. When you learned that, did you connect it to the growing power of these groups?
Yeah, I mean, I would say several experts connected it to the growing power of these groups when I spoke with them. I mean, many of them told me that they worried that these well-funded anti-science groups and movement could lead to devastating long-term public health consequences. You know, and they say that measles is kind of the tip of the iceberg on that. And I would just also caution, this is combined as well in the U.S. with a movement by conservative and libertarian forces to really roll back public health powers. So public health officials, you know, don't even have the same ability to quarantine or isolate in some cases in some states to really combat infectious diseases like measles. So we're really in a new world here when it comes to public health in the U.S.
Lauren Weber, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lauren Weber is Health and Science Accountability Reporter with The Washington Post.
In the 19th century, a new viewpoint emerged, which said math was a big game of rules. 1 plus 1 equals 2 isn't objectively true or false. It just depends on which rules and definitions you start with.
That's Kyne Santos sharing a math history lesson in a TikTok video. What you miss from just hearing that clip is Kyne's outfit. Fierce rainbow hair, awesome makeup, sparkles, sequins, glitter, and rhinestones. Kyne is a drag queen who shares history and math lessons to more than 1.5 million followers on TikTok. She dresses in what she calls high glamour drag and uses personal storytelling to illustrate, fabulously, how mathematical equations shape the world around us. Her new book, Math and Drag, came out this week. Good morning, Kyne. Welcome to Day 6.
Hi, Brent. Thanks for having me.
There aren't a lot of math holidays, but Thursday is Pi Day, March 14th. You're a drag queen who makes her own clothes. So how do you use pi in making a skirt?
Oh my gosh. Well, you're cutting out a big circle, right? It has to fit around your waist. But when you're measuring your waist, you're measuring the circumference of that circle. But when you're cutting it out, you're often cutting out a diameter or a radius. And pi, 3.14, is a number that connects a circle's circumference to its diameter. And what's really fun is that pi is the same in every circle, no matter how big or small. So that's just one of many, many applications of pi, is make it a skirt.
A lot of people tune out when they hear the word math, but you've managed to get people excited in it. And I just wonder if it's a misconception that math is a difficult subject to get people interested in.
Oh yeah, 100%. You know, math was my best subject growing up. I think that math has such a bad reputation because we all think that it's just about getting the right answers and following these arbitrary formulas and algorithms. And so many people don't even understand why they're doing this stuff. And so my message is just to show people that math can be fun, that math is everywhere around us in the world, and that math doesn't have to just be about getting the right answer. It can be creative, and it can be about problem solving, and it can be really quite elegant and interesting.
So they're listening to you, but they're also looking at you while you say this, and you're presenting as a drag queen. And in the Venn diagram of math nerds and drag queens, how much overlap is there? How many people are in that set with you?
Not very many, I guess. You know, when I started making these videos, I thought I was the only one who was in this little intersection of people who liked drag and sparkly things and people that also liked math. But I think that the greatest surprise has been that so many other people also like learning math in this way. Lots of people have been messaging me and commenting saying that they wish their professors wore big wigs and sparkly earrings. Maybe it would have made them pay attention a little bit more in math class.
What kind of response do you get from people who stumble on your work and then they finally feel seen, that there's identification?
I love it. You know, when I was young, I used to think that I couldn't be a mathematician or a scientist because I was gay and maybe I was too flamboyant. And I just didn't see many people in science or math that were like me. I thought I had to act a bit more straight and act like everybody else. But I think that really, math is just about what's in your head and what you can do, you know, on a chalkboard or with a pencil and paper. It doesn't matter what you look like. That's the message that I want to impart onto everybody.
In your chapter about imaginary numbers, actually, can you describe an imaginary number? Tell us what it is.
So the imaginary number I is defined as I squared equaling negative one. Students at home will think, how can you square a number and get negative one? You know, the square root of negative one is, we sometimes learn it as that is something that's just not allowed mm-hmm. in math. Mm-hmm. But the imaginary number, by creating that definition, by saying, yes, this is a number and it is allowed, we see that actually it enables us to do so much more with math. And you can actually see real life applications of it in physics and engineering and computer science.
But this is a breakthrough. When the imaginary number was actually conceived, this was a breakthrough. People had to think differently about what that number means and where it fit into the things that they believed all along. You also say in this chapter, it took time for the world to accept the legitimacy of zero. And you say the acceptance of different kinds of humans, and here we're talking about gender, is the same thing. Tell me about that.
We think of gender as something that should be so simple, like there are two genders, boys are boys and girls are girls, and we think that it's as simple as that. But I make the analogy to numbers. We used to think numbers were really simple. Numbers were things you could count. You know, you have one sheep, then two sheep, then 1 + 2 = 3. But then there are actually more hurdles for us to get over to accept that nothingness could be a number. Mm-hmm. Negative numbers could be numbers. Imaginary numbers can be numbers. And it took a while for people to wrap their heads around that. And I really think it's analogous to wrapping your head around the concept of different kinds of people, people who you may have never encountered in your day-to-day life, but who express themselves in a different way from what you're used to, people who, you know, identify with different genders. And I think that whether there are new numbers that we're learning about or new kinds of people that we're learning about, we shouldn't close our minds to that. We should have an open mind and just want to learn more about our universe and the people who we share it with.
Is there resistance to the things that you're doing as a drag queen presenting math?
I get loads of comments all the time. I could do a video about how to add up fractions and people will, you know, be commenting, oh my gosh, this is like, what does the world come to? All sorts of things that I'm sure you can just imagine the stuff that people say. But, you know, really my message is just that anybody can do math and anybody can love math, and it doesn't matter what you look like, right? These are just my clothes. This is just how I choose to present myself. It has nothing to do with what's in my head.
There is a lot of pushback right now towards drag queens in a pedagogical situation when there's kids involved. Mm-hmm. Are you dealing with that as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, people who have a prejudice against drag queens, trans people, queer people think that we don't belong in spaces where there are families and children involved. I think that it just shows that they think that queer people are inherently inappropriate or sexual just by virtue of us existing. And I think that that's totally wrong and misjudgment of us. You know, people for a long time have brought kids to shows where people are dressed up in costumes. You know, that's all this is.
You often incorporate queer history in your lessons, and you say you want your book to be a testament to the humanity of the queer community. Why is that important to you?
It's funny. When I started writing the book, I really just intended it for it to be a math book and to be about numbers and calculus and fractions. As I was writing and all of these drag bands were happening, that second goal started to emerge in my head to, you know, write this as a testament to our humanity, because I'm not the only one who's getting these sorts of comments. You know, around the country and around the world, people are having their rights taken away and people are being oppressed and being pushed down into the floorboards of our society. And I think that we need to be visible as a community and show people that, you know, we're more than just a stereotype. There's lots more to us. We are human just like everybody else.
So you have so much confidence. When I watch you on video and you're leaning into a problem and inviting us to come in with you, where did it come from in your life?
It's funny you say that. I really am such an introvert, and I always have been. I've slowly been getting better and better. My advice to everybody is I just fake it till you make it. That's my advice. You know, I started out sort of pretending to be confident as this like ironic, sarcastic joke I was doing, and then I think it just manifested into real confidence, to tell you the truth.
You write in the book that math is art, chaos, elegance, freedom, creativity, and abstraction. And you also draw parallels between math and queerness. How meaningful was it for you to find those parallels?
You know, it was incredibly meaningful because I haven't read another math book like this, and I don't think there is another math book like this out there. And I think that to have that representation, to have somebody draw these parallels and that overlap represents, you know, a bridge being created between two different communities that we once thought were in two separate worlds. And what is math other than drawing bridges between different branches that we once thought were disconnected?
Kind Santos, how are you going to celebrate Pi Day?
Oh gosh, well, I'm going to celebrate Pi Day. I'm going to eat loads and loads of pie and just, you know, share all the great news with all my followers.
It was really nice to meet you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kind Santos is a drag queen, mathematician, educator, and the author of Math in Drag. Still to come on Day 6, what happened to that book? Kids have questions about why books are being removed from their libraries in the Oscar-nominated short, The ABCs of Book Banning.
Have you ever longed to escape reality or fantasized about stepping into someone else's shoes, even for just a little while? Hi, I'm Laura Mullen.
And I'm Chris Tolley. We host CBC's Play Me, the immersive podcast that transforms theater into addictive audio fiction. Join us for a new season and disappear into a world rich with drama, where every show delivers hypnotizing stories and unveils intriguing characters with secrets.
Play Me, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Brent Bambury. You're listening to Day 6 from CBC Radio. We're on public radio stations across the United States, and you can listen on demand with the CBC Listen app. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts and at cbc.ca/day6. Do you remember the last time you used a payphone or even saw one? In Tacoma Park, Maryland, there's one left. It doesn't help you place calls, but it does give you a sense of place. David Schulman is an audio producer, composer, and musician, and sometimes he creates public art. In 2016, in collaboration with two other artists, David turned an old payphone into an interactive art display. And recently, the phone has been getting even more attention.
It looks pretty much like an old payphone, but there are a couple of things that are that should tell you that it's not going to work like that. There are a couple of feather banners that say the word bird calls on it, but it also has a bright canary yellow handset. You go to it, you pick up the handset, then you would immediately start hearing the dial tone.
This is your dial tone. It's a mourning dove. To hear another bird, press any key.
When you get to the bird calls phone, it's in this little commercial strip by a bus stop. Really, it doesn't look like a whole lot, and there's just a little piece of land there with this old armature, which probably went in decades ago to hold a payphone. You know, my hometown of Tacoma Park, Maryland, had this call for proposals a few years back because they wanted to do something to spruce up this kind of forgotten corner of town. But I thought it would be really great to be able to hotwire a payphone and put in the sounds of the local birds so that you'd hear the sounds of the birds that were actually all around you. And I teamed up with a local sculptor and an artist, but who also works with the physical aspects of sound. Brandon Hall is his name. And the bird calls were licensed by the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
Hashtag? You're thinking hashtag? Who needs Twitter when you can just tweet? That's a northern cardinal.
We're so caught up in technology, and that you would pick up this old piece of technology that's pretty much been discarded, and then you would hear these amazing sounds and these amazing behaviors of birds that were nearby, like some night herons squawking at each other. And then you might learn from the phone that they actually been nesting down in Sligo Creek, just down the hill. So you might look up and see them.
Night herons, on the water. There are two kinds, black-crowned and yellow-crowned. Both grow extravagant plumes on their heads.
The phone has gotten more attention just recently. I mean, I think it was almost like in a quiet hibernation where people in the neighborhood would know it was there. People at the bus stop, students would sometimes come by. But then it got some more attention, and then I started hearing from people. They thought it was quirky, but they also thought it was peaceful to, like, introduce the sound of birds again into our urban experience. I've heard from nature centers and zoos that are now thinking, hey, maybe we could put in some of these here too. But it is interesting to think about what about our current moment makes this idea and the sounds especially appealing. For me, I'm wondering if it has to do with, like, you know, all the stress and angst and anger that we get when we listen to our other forms of communication these days. And there's something really transporting about listening to the sounds of the birds, communicating with each other, and hearing this whole other way of life. The birds profoundly live by the seasons. And so listening to them and hearing their voices really expresses this passage of time and the moment when, you know, things are trying to renew themselves. One of my favorite sounds on the phone is a secret. If you press a conventional phone with the numbers 411, like you're trying to get some directory assistance, that's what you hope for. And instead you get migratory assistance.
411 bird calls, migratory assistance. Can I help you?
That's a favorite for me also because it's got all these different sounds of the birds squawking out together. It sounds like they're in the middle of their workday.
Okay, got it. I wouldn't worry. Your route doesn't look bad as the crow flies.
I am so aware of how relentless and really tyrannical all the human squawking that we are subject to and we have subjected ourselves to just has become. I just love it that there could be an option for some people, at this point, like one listener at a time, to pick up an old payphone and hear the birds.
Fly safe.
David Shulman is an audio producer, composer, and musician in Tacoma Park, Maryland.
If you were the person who helped ban this book, why? Just why? Like, do you feel like Rosa Parks is a bad person? Do you feel like her legacy, people should not know about her legacy? Why do you choose to do this? I'm just curious.
Good questions, right? That's the voice of a young student in Florida asking why the children's book, The Life of Rosa Parks, was banned from her school library. She's one of the many students featured in the documentary The ABCs of Book Banning. It's nominated for an Oscar this year in the short doc category. Book bans have been on the rise in the U.S. in the past few years. According to the film, more than 2,000 books have been banned in at least 37 states, including Florida. The books targeted often deal with LGBTQ rights and Black history. Books removed from school libraries include The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, The Diary of Anne Frank, and The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. The documentary doesn't have a narrator. It illustrates the impact of the bans by listening to the students affected by them. Sheila Nevins is a prolific, award-winning documentary producer. She has produced more than 1,000 documentaries for HBO. She is now the head of MTV Documentary Films and the director of the ABCs of Book Banning. Sheila Nevins, good morning. Welcome to Day 6.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
You've produced a lot of documentaries, but I read this is the first documentary that you've directed in your long career. Is that true?
It's true that it was brought to my attention that in my aggressive, let's do it this way personality, I was actually directing it. I'm not 100% sure I haven't done similar things before, but this was the first time, because we were under a very tight schedule, that it was very obvious to everyone involved in it, the two wonderful women I was working with, Trish and Naz. It was very obvious to all of us that I was more engaged, more active, and more just in a much more forceful decision-making mode.
And how much of that had to do with the subject matter here?
A lot. The subject matter sort of grew in my heart. I was a red diaper baby, and I must say I searched for causes my whole life, which is probably why I've been in documentaries, because the ones that were most important were the ones that nudged the world a little bit, that mm-hmm. made a difference, that made people see things the way they hadn't seen them before. So I was always looking for that little crack in what seemed obvious that wasn't so obvious. And this was that crack.
And what about before that, before your career, when you were a child growing up? What about your relationship to literature, to books, to the libraries? How important was it?
Very important. I was not a rich kid. I couldn't buy books. So the library, I think it was on 10th Street and 2nd Avenue in New York City, it was my home in many ways. I would take books out, and when I would return them, it's funny you ask, because I really didn't remember this until right now. I remember the librarian said, "You read the whole book already?"
Mm-hmm.
But no, books were my visionaries. They were my guiding lights. They told me that there was more out there than, you know, between school and home. And I think the thought that other children, you know, some 80, 70 years later, would be deprived of these books, and many of them were classics that were around in my time, the fact that they would be deprived was chilling. It wasn't just, oh, let's do a film about book banning. It was, let's protect these kids from being deprived in this way.
Let's talk about the kids, because that's who you have centered in this film. It's the children who are being deprived that we hear from. And you say at the very beginning of the film, we're not going to talk to the people about why these books are being banned. But
well, they have microphones. They can reach the microphones. I wanted to talk, certainly in the beginning of the film and through most of it, to the kids who can't reach up to the microphone because it's not being lowered for them. Yeah. I wanted them to speak out.
But you said earlier that when you were a child, the books showed you a life that was more diverse than the life that you could imagine. So the people banning books clearly don't want a diverse world to be presented to those kids. But is it really about the books, or is it something else? Is it really about exercising power over a group of people that you don't want to flourish?
I don't know how to answer that, because I don't want power over anyone. I want freedom. Anyone can believe what they want. You don't want to read the book? Don't read it. You don't want your one kid to read that book? Okay. You know, it's your privilege, I guess. You know, but you cannot legislate for a world of children or a state of children or a district of children, because that's not appropriate. You can believe in whatever God you want. You can believe that, you know, there's only man and only woman, and that's how God created it. That's fine. But, you know, that's for you to believe. You know, some people like spaghetti with tomato sauce, and some people like it with cheese sauce. You know, pick what you like. It is a free world.
And the kids that you speak to, the kids that you present to us, they want the freedom to read these books, and they can't understand why the books are being withheld. One of the kids that you spoke with, Kieran, talked about Mouse by Art Spiegelman, which is banned. And this is the story, Mouse is the story of Art Spiegelman's father, who was a Holocaust survivor.
Yes. It's a book that explains the loneliness and the deprivation of losing your freedoms. It's a wonderful book. Why would you deprive an age-appropriate child from reading that book? Why? Would you take away World War II? I don't know. I guess if you just whitewash history.
What did you think about the way Kieran in your film grappled with the questions that you just asked about why these works should be bold?
I wish I had said it instead. I think the kids were able to put in their own words things that I don't think I could as eloquently express, because I think I had a certain element of fury in the deprivation, and they simply had an inquisitive kind of selfhood. They were not at all furious, but they were deprived of them. The young girls in Florida were deprived of the books. One of them actually helped take some of the books off the shelves, and then there was nothing for them to read. They wanted to read more advanced books, and they couldn't get them. So, I mean, it's terrifying to think that you can't read about the world you live in and about difference, all kinds of difference, racial difference. You can't read your own history. You can't read about witches because there's only one God. You can't have a different God because there's only one God. I mean, the real issue here is don't hurt children. And one of the ways you don't hurt children is by allowing them to be free, by giving them age-appropriate books to discover the world they're going to have to, in this case, fix and live in and have their own children in it. So why would you deprive them in their learning years of information? I can't understand it.
When you spoke with the kids in the film, did it give you hope?
Did it give me hope? No, it made me sad. It made me sadder. I mean, I thought it had an element of charm. But then when I stayed away from the charm or the humor of it all, I felt the seriousness of it all. This is a very serious film. This is a film that should make you cry because of what the children don't have. This is a film about the future. It's not really about the present, because these children are the future. And it's a deprived future for these children. And it's growing. What was 1,000 books is 2,000 books is 3,000 books is now close to 5,000 books. And it's not just for, you know, children. It's all through education. It goes through to the college level books that have racial history in them that are banned. It's not to be believed. This is a democracy. We have freedom of speech. It's unbelievable. I don't know. I'm not living in Canada. But I have a friend who said you may not like this. They said after seeing the film, they wanted me to move to Canada.
I can help you find an apartment if you want to come up.
You can. Reasonable, I hope.
Sheila Nevins, listen, it was great to talk to you. Congratulations. Best of luck at the Oscars.
Thank you so much. And thank you for talking to me.
Sheila Nevins is the director of the ABCs of Book Banning. It's up for an Oscar this year, and it's available on Paramount Plus.
Time, weather,
Rift from the headlines.
And here we go. This is Riff from the Headlines, our weekly quiz. Three riffs linked by one story in the news. If you guess the story that links the riffs, you could win a Day 6 tote bag. First, here's a recap. This is last week's clue.
I've got a theory that it's a demon, a dancing demon. No, something isn't right there.
I've got a theory, some kid is dreaming, and we're all stuck inside his wacky Broadway.
I have a theory from Buffy, the Vampire Slayer. Missing by Everything But the Girl, and Ben Folds 5 with Kate. And Tanya Isaac of Courtney, BC, correctly guessed the headline that we're looking for. Speculation about the whereabouts of the Princess of Wales runs rampant. The internet has theories. Congratulations, Tanya. A Day 6 tote bag will be on its way to you soon. Now, here's this week's clue.
And I promise not to leave your side. One shot, two shots, three shots, four, five shots, six shots, 7 shots more.
And we're looking for the story that connects those riffs. Email us your answer. Put Riff from the Headlines in the subject. Send it to day6@cbc.ca and please include your mailing address. One right answer will be picked at random. The prize is a Day 6 tote bag. You can always hear the clues again anytime at cbc.ca/day6.
Time, weather, and
Lift from the headlines.
And that's our show for this week. Day 6 was produced by Lori Allen, McKenna Hadley Burke, Sarah Melton, and Pedro Sanchez. Our senior producer is Gord Westmacott, and I'm Brent Bambury. It's 6 days to the Russian presidential election, 1 day to the Oscars, and 7 days till we meet again on Day 6.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.